This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. This week, East Carolina University broke ground on a new dental clinic in Thomasville called a Community Service Learning Center. The 7,700-square-foot facility will give four-year dental students an opportunity to hone their skills as they provide oral health care services to underserved areas in and around Davidson County. The center will be a needed facility to help make up for the shortfall in access to dental health care in our state. Dean of ECU's School of Dental Medicine, Dr. Greg Chadwick, says North Carolina is ranked 47th in the nation in dentists per capita.
When you look nationally, all the way across the country, that's the large states and the small states, that number is about 6 dentists per 10,000. North Carolina's average is about 4.4 dentists per 10,000.
Dr. Chadwick explains that interpreting North Carolina statistics are complicated because there's a wide variance between urban and rural areas of the state. He says North Carolina is broken down into 15 counties considered urban, which include the Triangle, Charlotte, Greensboro, and Asheville, and 85 rural counties. Urban areas have 5 or more dentists per 10,000 people, but in rural areas, the average is 3 dentists per 10,000 people or less. 3 counties in eastern North Carolina don't have dentists at all.
Camden County, Terrell, and Hyde are the 3 counties that at this point don't have a dentist. And one of those, Gates County, now has a dentist that drives in from Virginia.
To make up for the shortfall in dentists and oral health care in the state, East Carolina University currently operates 4 community service learning centers, 2 of which are here in eastern North Carolina.
The first one was in Ahoskie. That's been in operation about 2.5 years. The second was Elizabeth City, and it's been in operation about 2 years.
There's also community service learning centers in Silva and Lillington. Centers in Spruce Pine and Robeson County are set to open this winter, and another in Brunswick County is scheduled for completion in late spring 2015. In Elizabeth City, the state-of-the-art facility has 16 treatment rooms, one that's designed to accommodate patients in a wheelchair. The center also houses x-ray machines and telemedicine technology. Director of the Elizabeth City Community Services Learning Center, Dr. Carol Anderson, says they help around 35 people on a daily basis.
Being in an area that's been historically underserved, you might well expect that we have quite a few urgent needs that need to be addressed, but we also see a lot of children. We've put a lot of focus on children and preventive care here in Elizabeth City, doing the baby oral health exams and just trying to get the kids to the point where they're not going to need a whole lot of restorative services in the future.
Like all of the centers, the Elizabeth City facility offers comprehensive general dentistry, oral surgery, root canals, sealants and tooth-colored fillings, crowns and bridges, dentures, and implant services. The centers are placed strategically in areas with the most need. Still, patients travel long distances to receive dental care from the Elizabeth City Center. Dr. Anderson says they receive people from Bertie, Camden, Chowan, Currituck, Gates, Pasquotank, and Perquimans counties. While one of the aspects of ECU's community service learning centers is to improve access to oral health care in the state, another is to give students experience working in a professional environment.
We function more like a private practice. They get the experience of working with dental auxiliaries, dental assistants, and dental hygienists. They also have the benefit of having the front desk schedule patients for them and do all the business procedures. Also, they will get to see more patients during the course of the time that they're here.
The dental students move to a different community service learning center every 6 to 8 weeks, so they're exposed to different experiences and challenges. At the Elizabeth City facility, there's currently 4 students performing dental procedures under the supervision of Dr. Anderson.
I usually have a cluster of 4, and I stay somewhere within that cluster most of the time, so I can get to them at any given moment if necessary. Most of the time, none of that happens, but I'm always available.
ECU's community service learning centers are open Monday through Friday, 8 to 5. Medicaid and other insurance plans are accepted. Emergency services are provided on a walk-in basis. For more information on a community service learning center in your region, go to ecu.edu and click on Dental School. The Yadkin River is by no means a tributary of the Caspian Sea. About the only thing the Blue Ridge Mountains and the Black Sea have in common is the reference to color in their names. And yet, in Caldwell County, you'll find the only farm on the continent that produces one of the world's most expensive delicacies. WFAE's Tom Bullock reports.
The farm is an anonymous compound of long red sheds nestled behind a cornfield on the outskirts of Lenore, just off Indian Grave Road.
This is the last place you would expect to find a sturgeon farm, right, in Happy Valley?
This is Elizabeth Wall, and she's right. Yet this is a fish farm in the foothills of the Blue Ridge, the only one in North America that produces not fish roe, but high-quality, real caviar.
It's not from sturgeon, it's not caviar.
Wall runs marketing and sales for Atlantic Caviar and Sturgeon. The company was dreamed up by four friends back in 2000.
One of them was a cargo pilot, and he was flying in and out of Russia where he would refuel his jets and also refuel himself on a little bit of caviar.
But, says Wald, he was more than just a consumer. He was also a realist and a conservationist who saw what overfishing and the dramatic jump in caviar production after the fall of the Soviet Union would create.
He could see the writing on the wall that pretty soon most of the fish were going to be endangered, and today all sturgeon are.
In 2005, the U.S. government banned the import of caviar from the beluga sturgeon, the most expensive and sought-after kind. It was that same year Atlantic Caviar and Sturgeon broke ground on their facility.
This is our nursery.
And the first thing you notice about a sturgeon farm, it's really dark.
Tom, your eyes will adjust here in a minute. We keep it dark, mainly for heat and cooling, and also to keep them from going into spawn.
The second thing you notice, the 32 giant corrugated metal tubs, the fish tanks, each of which is covered by what looks like a giant hairnet.
The nets are here because the sturgeon are huge jumpers. In the wild, they've been known to jump up onto the decks of sailing ships.
They have around 20,000 sturgeon in these tanks from three different breeds, Atlantic, Siberian, and Russian. And any one of them could pack a wallop. Sturgeon date back to prehistoric times. Some of these armor-plated dinosaur-era fish grow to 5 or 6 feet long. Elizabeth Wall says the cash cow of this farm is the Russian sturgeon, which produces a type of caviar known as Ocetra.
And it's probably comparable to beluga caviar in the world of people who know caviar.
But unlike the banned beluga, this caviar is available and, they say, completely sustainable. They buy eggs from a sustainable farm in Germany. When the sturgeon hatch, they do so in a closed water system that circulates well water through the tanks.
So it's all natural North Carolina, Blue Ridge, pristine mountain water.
Which, says Wall, is more environmentally friendly and creates a better tasting caviar. The fish, of course, have to eat. Sturgeon are bottom feeders, so they're fed with pellets that fall to the bottom of the tanks. 50 pounds worth per day per tank. Anything that eats, well, produces waste. The fish waste is filtered and used to fertilize nearby cornfields. And each fish is tagged for tracking as well as for study. North Carolina State is a partner in the farm. The school studies the sturgeon as they grow to learn all they can about one of the most mysterious types of fish on the planet. But eventually, all things must end, especially if you're a mature sturgeon on a caviar farm. That's when they're moved into what's known as the staging area,
which is kind of like a little hospice for fish.
One by one, the fish are harvested, weighed, washed, the meat cut into fillets, packaged, and sold to restaurants.
One of my biggest buyers is Lincoln Restaurant in New York at the Metropolitan Opera at Lincoln Center.
The precious eggs are separated out, the impurities plucked out by a steady hand and a good set of tweezers. Then the caviar is lightly salted by weight and packed in a tin. The caviar here is deemed of such quality that famous purveyors like Petrosian of Paris carry North Carolina caviar. And Atlantic Caviar and Sturgeon has a ton to sell, literally.
It's 2.2 pounds to a kilo, and we're looking at about 1,000 kilos for 2015.
With a sticker price of $80 an ounce for much of their caviar. Still, this fish farm has yet to make a profit.
Well, not yet, just because of the years that we've been sinking money into it.
It takes 7 years to raise a female sturgeon. This harvest is only their third. But the demand for farmed caviar continues to rise, and more stores are looking to sell it. This month, Whole Foods stores across North Carolina started selling caviar from this farm under the Caviar Star brand. For WFAE News, I'm Tom Bullock.
This Saturday, Tryon Palace in New Bern is having its Eve of Revolution, a Christmas candlelight celebration. It includes costume characters, tours of historic homes adorned with 18th, 19th, and 20th century decorations, and the heart-moving rhythms of John Canoe. Today, Mac McKee speaks with Marketing and Communications Manager at Tryon Palace, Craig Ramey, about this weekend's event.
Craig, thank you for joining us today on the Down East Journal. This Saturday is the last weekend, December, the weekend of the 20th, that folks in eastern North Carolina can experience Eve of Revolution. Now, can you tell us approximately how many years the event's been presented at Tryon Palace?
Well, we celebrate Christmas every year, but we try to have a different theme every year that we do that as well. So this is our first year of having Eve of Revolution, but we have candlelight celebrations and Christmas celebrations every year, and we've been doing it for just about 20 years now.
So really what you've basically done, apart from just add the beauty of the season, you've added an educational element to it as well.
Well, that's certainly a big part of our mission at Tryon Palace. We want people to be able to associate having fun with learning about history. So we always want to make sure that we've got something that appeals to everyone, you know, of all ages, and they can come and they can see that when you are experiencing history, when you see people in costume, it's more of a visceral experience that you can take home with you.
Now, the event picks four revolutionary military events that both shaped and changed American history. The American Revolution, the War of 1812, the American Civil War, and World War II. In your opinion, what were some of the major aspects of these time periods that made them uniquely relevant and still interesting today?
Well, I think the connecting theme is really a sense of hope. It's a time when things may not be going so well in the present, but there's this hope that things are going to be better in the future. And that hope is certainly something that people commonly have around Christmas time as well. And so there's definitely that line that's drawn between these historical events and the Christmas that we're experiencing today.
The Christmas season always brings out a lot of tourists. In your experience at Tryon Palace, do you think the Christmas season can sometimes rival even the busy spring and summer tourist season?
It absolutely can. You know, people get this idea of what they think they're going to get when they come to Tryon Palace all throughout the year. They know they're going to come and they're going to see people in costumes, they're going to see history, they're going to see historical buildings. But what's interesting about, you know, around late November and December is they can see it decorated in a way that's unlike any other way they've ever seen it. We have a decorator come in and she does a fantastic job of, you know, having a little bit of modern flair as well as some of the more traditional decorations that you would see. And it's really breathtaking. And it's been nice to hear from the public the last 2 years. People are saying that it's getting better and better, and that's what we want to hear.
Give our listeners a thumbnail sketch overall of what to expect for the evening during the Eve of Revolution.
Sure. So people will arrive. They'll come through the front gates. Immediately, they're going to see several U.S. Marines in uniform taking toys, toy donations for Toys for Tots. They're going to walk in, and then they're going to see a circus tent where you'll have performers doing various acts. We'll have the Pickle Brothers. These guys do like sword swallowing and fire eating and things like that. And then you can go to any of the historical homes and go on a tour. You can go inside the Commission House where you'll have a World War II experience. You can go inside the Stanley House where we have the War of 1812. In the Hay House, we'll have the Civil War. And then, of course, the highlight of everyone's evening is the palace, where they can go in and they can experience the true Eve of Revolution, the Revolutionary War.
Now, I understand that you also have a fireworks display.
That's absolutely correct. You know, people come out and they just have such a fun family time all night, bouncing from one place to the other. But people always want to stick around for the grand finale, which is the black powder fireworks that we have on the South Lawn. It's not just like the fireworks that you might expect from 4th of July, and it's even more different because, you know, you can smell the smoke and feel the heat of it. It's a very different experience for fireworks, and to see that in that historical setting is just breathtaking.
What are the ticket prices, Craig, and where can folks get more information about the Eve of Revolution?
The ticket prices for adults are $20. For children, they're $10. And then, of course, for anyone that is a member of the Tryon Palace Foundation, they're $15. And tickets are available at Tryon Palace at the North Carolina History Center. And we also have them available online.
And if you could give us that website address once again for Tryon Palace.
It's www.tryonpalace.org.
Greg, thank you so much for being our guest today on the Daily East Journal.
Thank you.
The Down East Journal is made possible by our Public Radio East members in partnership with Crystal Coast Civic Center, Moorhead City, where every event is waterfront, business meetings and special event facilities available. Crystal Coast Civic Center, 252-247-3883. This weekend, Toy Trains of Belhaven, a popular Christmas exhibit in Washington County, will showcase a miniature winter wonderland dotted with buildings, villagers, lights, and tracks. But the star of the show is a collection of 10-plate toy trains running through elaborately decorated holiday villages. Today, Michael Peterson has more on the elaborate setup that's sending young and old alike to the birthplace of the Atlantic Intercoastal Waterway.
Today I'm speaking with Don Stark, who is the owner of the Toy Train exhibit featured in Belhaven's Christmas with Toy Trains. Don, can you tell me or explain to me what Christmas with Toy Trains is about?
For me, it evokes the memories that I had on Christmas morning. There was trains running under the tree. What we've done here is create a fairly large display. They're the kind of train that companies like Lionel made in the 1920s, 1930s.
Oh, that sounds very interesting. Now, is it just one big toy train, or do you have several on display?
We're able to run four trains at the same time, and we have about 200 feet of track. The display overall is like 300 square feet. There's lots of activity throughout the display. An amusement park with a merry-go-round and Ferris wheel and bump-em cars, and we have a circus, and we have a town, and we have a harbor with boats, a plane that flies overhead, and a hot air balloon.
So the display has evolved. You add new things. What other new things can we expect this year?
One of the things that we've tried to do over the last couple of years is add buttons that are around the display that when the children come, particularly, they want to be able to participate, and this gives them some accessory that they're able to operate.
Now, this is your third year doing this event. Why do you think people associate toy trains with Christmas?
Toy trains were something that happened almost the same time as trains came into our lives. The toys followed very quickly behind, and somewhere along the line, somebody began to do these little villages under the Christmas tree. And then with the village, they said, well, what activity can we create? So I think that's how it happened, was that the trains got associated with the village. There's a kind of a German tradition to it. I know in Pennsylvania they have what they call the puts. They would create these little cardboard buildings.
Now, how much does it cost to see the exhibit, and how has the public's response been so far?
The public has been just terrific. There is no charge to come to see the display. For my wife and I, and for the whole team that put this together, this is our Christmas gift to the community, and it's something that we enjoy sharing.
Now, do you see people come back year after year?
We've had some who come back week after week, and especially some of the children.
I've seen the pictures, and it looks incredible. How many hours does it take to construct an exhibit like this, and when do you start?
Well, we started this year in October. We were doing some basic maintenance on the room, some painting and all that. And then we decorate the room with things that we can't access once the display is in place. It kind of evolves as you go along. And we've been doing this enough times that we kind of have a pattern to it. But luckily, we have a very good, hardworking team that's been willing to pitch in. I couldn't do it without them.
Oh, and speaking of teams real quick, how many volunteers do you have?
I think 7. We've worked them really hard, unfortunately, but it's been, we have some people who work at it a long time, almost every day, and some people who come and occasionally and help. We create our own little world.
Now, the exhibit is located in Belhaven at the Old Town Hall. What are the times people can go see the toy trains?
On Fridays, we're open from 1 to 4 and 5 to 7. And on Saturday and Sunday, we're open from 12 to 5. We wanted to include that evening hours on Fridays because it looks especially interesting at night, because we have all the lights, all the buildings are lit, and there's lights all over the platform, and the trains, of course, have lights in them, and it makes a very interesting thing.
And if people want to go and see the exhibit, how can they get more information about the event?
We do have a Facebook page. Search for Toy Trains of Belhaven.
Don, I want to thank you for talking with me. I do hope that you have a safe and happy holiday.
Well, thanks, Michael, and happy holidays to you, too.
This is Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. Many of our listeners will remember that we spoke 2 weeks ago about poinsettias, and poinsettias are not the easiest Christmas plant to save for next year. However, there are two Christmas plants that not only are easy keepers, but they get better from year to year, and those are Christmas cactus and amaryllis. Christmas cactus bloom in a range of colors, pink, purple, salmon, even white. And when they get done blooming, they make a nice little attractive houseplant. When your Christmas cactus finishes blooming, simply pinch off the end of each branch. Christmas cactuses have little modified leaflets on their branch. Just pinch off about 2 of them on each branch to keep your plant bushy and full. And keep it in some bright light. Give it a quarter turn every couple of days, and that plant will grow very nicely through to the spring for you. Amaryllis bulbs, which we often get as forced bulbs, will also keep. Make sure that it's planted in a little bit of potting soil with about half the bulb exposed. So if your amaryllis came to you in a glass of water or in a vase, go ahead and pot it up in some good potting soil. And again, keep it in a brightly lit window. Both of these plants will grow until spring in the house, and then after the last frost in the spring, you can move them outside. Amaryllis can be planted in the ground. I encourage them to be planted in a location that has good drainage. If your soil stays wet, the bulb may rot, but a raised bed or another area with good drainage is an excellent location for an amaryllis. Plant it in the ground with just the top of the bulb exposed, and that plant will grow straight on through the summer, and at the first frost, it'll die back to the ground. But each year, those amaryllis will come back and bloom in early summer for you. Christmas cactus are going to need to come back into the house in the fall. Christmas cactus bloom based on day length, so the easiest thing to do is in the spring, move that Christmas cactus outside to a location where it's going to get some morning sun but afternoon shade, and keep it outside until temperatures start to drop again in the fall. They will not tolerate a frost outside, so when it starts getting down into the mid-40s at night, go ahead and bring that Christmas cactus inside. Try to put it in a room that doesn't have a lot of lights in it, because lights will disrupt the short days that cause that Christmas cactus to set its flowers. If it doesn't flower right at Christmas for you, it may flower later in the winter for you. Some will flower around Easter instead. But just remember that long night, short day is what tells the Christmas cactus it's time to bloom. So when you get done with your Christmas plants and the poinsettia goes to the compost pile, go ahead and make sure that you save that Christmas cactus and your amaryllis and keep them around to make your garden more beautiful next year. This is Lisa Rayburn, Onslow County Cooperative Extension, with this week's edition of The Garden Journal.
Thanks for listening to the Downeast Journal this week. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, drop us a line at publicradioeast.org. Have a Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays.
Giddy-up, 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 let's go, let's look in the snow. We're riding on a wonderland of snow. Giddy-up, giddy-up, it's grand, just holding your hand. We're gliding along with the song of a wintry fairyland. Outside our cheeks are rosy and nice and cozy are we. We're cuddled up together like birds of a feather would be. Let's take that road before us and sing a chorus or two. Come on, it's lovely weather for a sleigh ride together with you. Da 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 da